This week on Behind the Lens. 7 of New Orleans' almost 80 charter schools are up for renewal this year as the NOLA Public School District steps up communication with parents about schools at risk of being shut down. And a dispute over the distribution of tourism tax revenue between the Regional Transit Authority and the Montreal Convention Center may end up in court. We'll have the details. Also, students in New Orleans participated in Friday's global climate strike, a young generation worried about sea level rise, the planet, and their future. I'm Jessica Rosegard. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
A little over a month into the 2019-2020 school year, and the NOLA Public School District is looking ahead to next year and the future of 7 charter schools that are up for renewal. Lens education reporter Marta Jusen is here with more. Hi, Marta.
Hey, Jess.
There are 7 charter schools that are up for renewal this year. Tell me first, how many charter schools are in the whole district, and is that number sort of typical for how many you might see renewed in any given year?
Yeah, I think about 10 seems right, although we do have an anomaly of a year coming up in 2 years. We're going to have 20 schools, which is a quarter of the New Orleans Public School District, up for renewal. So that is going to just be a whole different interesting scenario. But yep, there are only 7 this year.
And to be clear, charter operators usually run more than one school. So of the 7 up for renewal, how many charter operators are involved?
This year, each school that's up for renewal is actually under its own operator. So it's a single nonprofit that's running a school. And as a charter group, you get a contract to run a school for 5 years. And now in their, coming up to the end of their 5th year, they're being evaluated. And that's where we're going with this renewal process. The 7 schools up this year are Andrew Wilson, Foundation Prep, Carver Collegiate, Joseph Craig, Langston Hughes, Cog Hill, and the Net Central City.
So how does the process work? You mentioned that every charter is for 5 years and then there's just renewal. But what are the criteria that the schools are reviewed on?
So the schools are reviewed on academics, obviously, and they're also reviewed on, compliance and some operational matters. But those generally factor in a lot less. So academics are first and foremost the most important thing. We have seen charters in the past get in trouble based on, things such as financial matters, but often that was a school that was, ranked a D or a little bit lower anyways.
One of the 7 schools, Cog Hill, got a notice that they're in jeopardy. Why are they in jeopardy? And is there anything they can do at this point to get themselves into better favor with the school district?
So they're in jeopardy because they're projected to get an F on the state performance scores, which they're not actually due out until maybe the end of October, early November. But I know the district has made a concerted effort to be better at communicating with parents. So they sent out letters in the spring saying, hey, just so you know, your school's up for renewal. Now they've sent out this other letter that's basically says, hey, the school's probably going to be closing at the end of the year. And by closing, I want to be clear that the charter group that runs it is going to close. Cog Hill could very well and actually probably will stay open. It will just have a new charter group take over it. But I do think it's important. I do think it's important and okay to use the word close, because we're effectively closing a charter operator that didn't work well. So I do think it's good for the district to acknowledge that they are closing something.
And which charter operator is currently running Cog Hill, and what's their status?
It's called Better Choice Foundation, and Cog Hill is the only school they've ever run. So if they do lose this contract, which it looks like they're going to lose, probably they're going to cease to exist. That's what most single operator charter groups have done in the past if they lost their school.
And are failing grades the only problem at Cog Hill?
They are not. They've come under district scrutiny for a number of financial matters, and they've also just recently been looked at for special education problems. One parent went to the district and said, I don't think my kid is getting their special education services. And then when the district went and took a look, they found 7 other kids who also weren't getting served. Those are all things that are going to come up in their annual review. So, more than likely, Better Choice Foundation is not going to be running that school this year. And I think that's why the district is trying to be so upfront about it with parents.
Yeah. How disruptive is it for parents, for the district, for the whole system when a school loses its charter?
I think it's a really tough thing. What we know is that if students leave a failing school and they end up in a better school, that is good for them overall. But that doesn't get into kind of the nitty-gritty of that last year in a school. And if you're 1 month into the year and you hear that your school group is not going to be running your school next year, you know, that can leave a lot of uncertainty for not necessarily families, because I do think the Coghill building is probably going to stay open, so the school will stay open with a new operator, but certainly for employees and teachers who right now work for Better Choice Foundation. If a new charter group comes in, do they want to keep those same teachers? I think that's where you kind of see a lot of the rub. Although I know teachers are, you know, very committed to their students, but certainly they're probably thinking about next year.
And also for families, though, if the school itself is going to remain under some kind of operation, there will still be classes at that building. So kids can still technically go to school at that building, but it's a different operator, which might have different rules that parents might not choose in this system of school choice.
Exactly. So it's a choice system. You know, maybe you like Coghill because right now they run with this curriculum and they have these kind of rules or activities or whatever. So exactly. It's very interesting when you think about, you know, having a new operator come in and take this school over, they could be doing things very differently. But I do think that's why the district tries to be more upfront about things. So they're letting parents know in advance of one app opening, which is our centralized enrollment system that'll open in November, which I think, you know, is the nice thing to do. So parents can start researching, hey, do we want to go to a new school? Do we want to wait and see who's coming here? And then, you know, make an informed decision about what they want for their kid.
And credit to the school district for communicating that early and in advance so that parents are not caught off guard or given short notice that their kid's school might be closing down.
Right, which is very different from years past when schools were not necessarily communicating that. And of course they weren't, because if you lose kids, you're going to lose funding. So schools did not necessarily have an incentive to tell parents that they were up for renewal, and now the district is making them do that.
And this five-year charter, how do the sort of grades throughout those 5 years play into a decision as to whether or not to renew a charter?
You know, that's one of the interesting parts about our system is that the grade that matters most is the one that comes in that final year. So, you know, we have one school that's going up this year, Craig. They had an F last year. They were allowed to stay open. If Craig gets an F again, I don't think they're staying open. So you certainly do see what seems to be a varying set of standards, you know, when you close a school 1 year but not a different year. Although I do understand that overall they're saying, hey, charters, you had, you know, 5 years or more, depending on the length of your contract, to get this right. And if you didn't do it by then, you know, you don't get to stay open anymore.
And what about the other schools that are up for renewal this year? How are they looking?
It's a mix of D and C schools, other than Craig, which was an F last year. And then we also have the NET, which is an alternative high school, which is more than likely going to be an F, because that's just kind of how alternative schools end up scoring on the regular standardized score when they're put in with other high schools. But the district does take other measures into account for alternative schools. So an F for an alternative school is not, you know, necessarily a detrimental thing. And I spoke to the NET's founder, and, you know, she says that they're meeting all their benchmarks, and so they're probably going to stay open.
So back to the whole communication thing, what kind of communication can parents expect from the NOLA Public School District in the next couple of weeks?
So the district told us that over the next week or two, they're going to be communicating with families. It sounds like they might be giving them these kind of estimates or anticipated grades, so they will know whether or not their school is going to stay open or if it's going to have a new charter operator. So that's probably going to come in the form of a letter, and we'll just stay tuned from there. The board meets next week, so hopefully, you know, Superintendent Henderson Lewis is going to provide some additional information, and he most likely will in his superintendent's report.
And then at what point is it actually decided that a charter is not being renewed, and how close in time to the opening of one app do we expect that?
That decision has to be made by December. So what I think will happen is, like, parents are going to get in these letters and they're going to hear whether or not what the superintendent is likely to recommend. He will probably make his recommendations public in November. And then kind of the tricky thing is here is he makes these recommendations and the board doesn't actually vote on them. The board can only vote to overturn them if they don't like them. And that's with a 2/3 vote. and they have a month to do that. Although they can opt to take a vote, you know, saying they affirm what he said and that they support it, and they won't be like pulling the rug out on anybody. So basically the timeline is we'll get scores in November. That's when, you know, right now the district is also completing annual reviews of schools. So going in, visiting, looking at special ed files, all that kind of stuff. And I think in November we'll also hear his recommendations. And then by December he will, you know, formally present them to the board. One app opens in November, but it's not due until February.
Marta Jason, thank you for that update.
Thank you.
There's a dispute in New Orleans over tourism tax revenue. It's taking place between the Regional Transit Authority, or RTA, and the Ernest N. Morial Convention Center. Michael Isaac Stein has been reporting on this for The Lens. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
What's the background to this tax revenue dispute?
So the dispute is over a $32 million fund, as well as $7 million in recurring revenue every year. And really, to understand how that dispute started, we unfortunately have to go all the way back to 1985. So in 1985, New Orleans voters approved a ballot measure for a 1% sales tax that would be dedicated to public transit. Now, one stipulation in that ballot measure was that hotel rooms would be exempt from the sales tax. And that's the way it went for, you know, a little over a decade. But then in 1999, the RTA sued the city, saying that they had to start collecting the sales tax from hotel room sales as well. So that kind of set off this legal dispute. The convention center, other tourism entities intervened in the lawsuit, and they basically settled with a kind of strange arrangement. So the settlement said that, okay, the 1% sales tax will now apply to hotel rooms, but the RTA will only be able to keep half of the revenue generated by it. And the other half would be split mostly between the convention center and the New Orleans Tourism and Marketing Corporation, which is a city body that, you know, markets the city to out-of-state visitors.
So a 1% sales tax that originally hotels were exempt from that additional sales tax. Then when hotels were brought on board to pay that sales tax, half of that 1% from hotels was split?
Right, just the 1% that applies to hotels. So the overall sales tax that applies to the whole city, that's the RTA's main funding source. But within that, the hotel, you know, room sales tax is a pretty significant portion, someplace between $12 and $14 million every year. So year after year in this arrangement, the RTA has been making these $7 million payments to the New Orleans Tourism and Marketing Corporation and Convention Center every year.
So they get all that sales tax, but then they owe that half of that 1% from hotels to the convention center.
That's right. And that's the way it went until February of this year. So in February, Flozell Daniels, who is the chairman of the RTA board, he sent a letter to the New Orleans Tourism and Marketing Corporation saying that they were not going to abide by the agreement anymore, that they were going to no longer make these payments. You know, the argument that they had was that, you know, there's a statute in the Louisiana Constitution that says that revenue from a tax that was passed for a specific purpose can't be spent for other things. So basically the tax was passed, you know, voters passed it to raise money for public transit, and now some of that money is being used for tourism and marketing. Also in that letter, they demanded that the convention center return all the money that they've received from this tax for, you know, 20 years or so now. And so the convention center has built up about $32 million in a fund that now the RTA is demanding back.
What ground does the RTA have to stand on in this fight? I mean, obviously, if the money comes to them and then they're supposed to basically cut a check to the convention center, they can refuse to do that. But where do things stand in this battle?
Yeah, it's a bit of a legal quagmire. There's a lot of overlapping cooperative endeavor agreements and you know, escrow accounts that have specific purposes to them. But the legal arguments that are laid out in that February letter, the first one being that tax revenue that was supposed to go to a specific function, a specific government function, need to go to that government function. So since this is a transit tax, it all needs to go to transit. The other argument specifically for that convention center account, that $32 million, that $32 million is supposed to go to what was referred to as the Phase 4 expansion of the convention center. That expansion was scrapped in 2007 after Katrina for various reasons. And now they've moved on to what they call Phase 5. And that's, you may have read about the new 1,200-room hotel that's coming to the convention center. It's been a little controversial because of the amount of public funding that it will get. But basically, the RTA is arguing that this money was specifically for the Phase 4 expansion, and so it cannot be used for the Phase 5 expansion. So those are some of the legal arguments, but I wouldn't, it's a complicated issue, and I'm not a lawyer. So how that works out in court, we'll see.
Why do we think there's going to be a legal battle over this issue?
Yeah, so on Tuesday this week, I was covering a committee meeting of the Exhibition Hall Authority, which is the governing body of the Convention Center. And at the end, they went into an executive session, which is closed to the public, to discuss potential litigation with the RTA. And then when we went and looked back at some of their prior agendas, we found that at two other recent meetings, they had also gone into executive sessions specifically to talk about, quote, prospective litigation regarding the Regional Transit Authority's continued legal obligations to contribute the agreed-upon portion of that hotel sales tax. Then looking at the RTA's agendas for the past 6 months or so, they've gone into executive sessions six different times to discuss that 1999 lawsuit that led to the current arrangement. And then also looking at the New Orleans Tourism and Marketing Corporation, they have also entered executive session, or at least plan to talk about potential litigation over this funding.
And where do the mayor and city council stand on this issue? What's their position on what should be done with this tax money?
So the city council's position is clear. After the RTA stopped making these payments in February, the city council passed a resolution basically supporting the RTA in that. It was a non-binding resolution, doesn't have much force, but it was throwing their support behind it. The mayor's position has been less clear. And that's actually a key point, because within that letter, basically the way that the RTA had wanted to settle this was through arbitration with the mayor. They requested that. To our knowledge, that hasn't happened. When we talked to the RTA several months ago, they said that hadn't happened, but the RTA, did not respond to questions on that this time. But yeah, she stayed fairly quiet on it. I haven't been able to find any time that she's spoken publicly on it or the administration has weighed in, which is interesting because, of course, one of the mayor's landmark issues has been her Fair Share initiative, which has been an attempt to steer more tourism dollars towards, general municipal services like infrastructure. So this seems well within the ballpark of that initiative. But I think for now she's stayed out of the fray. So we'll see where, she lands, if anywhere, on this issue.
We're talking about a lot of money if it turned out that the convention center had to pay back the RTA. What kind of financial shape is the RTA in, and what would they do with that money?
So back in April, when we first covered that city council resolution in support of the RTA, we had covered, what the RTA says they would do with this new money. So what they said is with the $32 million one-time payment, they would help grow their fleet of both diesel and electric buses. Jared Munster, who leads the RTA, he said that pre-Katrina, the city had 350 buses, but that today we're down to 132 fixed-route buses. So trying to increase that number and again, trying to phase in more electric vehicles would be where that one-time payment would go. For the recurring revenue, he said the RTA could use that money to add 98,000 hours of new bus service, and that would be a 20% increase from what we have right now. So, it's about creating more lines and making those lines more regular. You hear complaints a lot with the RTA about the consistency of buses coming along routes, right? If you miss a bus, do you have to wait an hour for the next one? What will that mean for your job? So going towards some of the common complaints that people have with the RTA.
Yeah, and that expansion, certainly post-Katrina, that expansion of local transit service to various neighborhoods and getting back to those hours that neighborhoods were serviced has really been a point of conversation, especially with our hospitality workers, many of whom can't get
home from work on late shifts because the buses aren't running.
Right, and that's another point that the RTA has made. You know, it's also, they argue, in the best interest of the tourism industry, right? If the tourism industry, you know, needs their workers to show up on time, a lot of them rely on a public transportation system that some people say is not very reliable. You know, we've heard over and over the differences between the pre-Katrina and post-Katrina status of public transportation in the city. And so I think there's still this fight, you know, to get back to where we were, not even to improve on that, but just to get back to where the city was before the storm.
Michael Isaac Stein, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
September 20th was a day of global protest. Inspired by Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old Swedish climate activist, hundreds of thousands of school-aged children on every continent took to the streets to demand action on climate change. Thunberg has made international headlines throughout the past year. In August of 2018, she started her demonstration, sitting every Friday outside of Swedish Parliament to protest climate change. She has since addressed climate change panels at the United Nations, European Parliament, and U.S. Congress, taking lawmakers to task for failing to implement policies to curb global warming. Here's part of Thunberg's opening statement to the House Climate Crisis Committee on September 18th.
I want you to listen to the scientists. And I want you to unite behind the science. And then I want you to take real action.
Lawmakers, including Louisiana Representative Garrett Graves, pressed Thunberg, asking why the United States should take steps towards emissions reductions when other countries aren't doing the same.
Here we are talking about reducing emissions, yet China, under the Paris Accords, are going to be increasing their emissions by nearly 50%, 5 gigatons annually. So while in the United States we need to continue investing in innovative solutions and exporting clean energy technologies, it makes no sense for us to be doing it if we're simply watching for increases in China.
Thunberg issued a sharp rebuke to Graves and other lawmakers.
Another perspective, I am from Sweden, it's a small country, and there it is the same argument. Why should we do anything? Just look at the US, they say. So just so you know, that is being used against you as well.
Save our future, save the earth! Save our future, save the earth! Save our future.
What started as a solo protest has inspired millions around the world. On Friday, at the uptown intersection of Napoleon and St. Charles Avenue, about 50 kids and their parents gathered to make their voices heard in the global strike against climate change. Across the street, children at Academy of the Sacred Heart were on recess, pressed up against the fence in their school uniforms, curious about what was going on.
Here. Is this okay? Yeah. This works.
Mia Serena Lemon is 9 years old. She goes to Bricolage and was at the protest with her parents. She wanted to tell me why she was demonstrating.
I'm here because there was a big protest for climate change, and I wanted to be a part of it.
Why did you want to be a part of it?
Because I don't want the polar bears to be stuck on ice, and I want the world to live.
Yeah.
Because it's a nice place.
Are you worried about climate change?
Yeah.
Why?
Because sooner or later, the ice caps are all gonna melt. And it's just bad for all the animals, and I love animals.
Yeah. When did you learn about climate change?
A couple of years ago.
And how? How did you learn about it?
I can't remember.
Was it your parents or maybe a friend?
I think. Papa, how did I learn about climate change?
So your parents told you.
Yeah.
What do you hope that kids your age can do to make this better?
Well, they could be here right now helping, and they can use less gas, which would really help, and stop burning fossil fuels. Like, people have huge grill parties, like, once a week. It's bad for the planet, but I think if they have them, like, twice a year, that would be better for the earth.
Mm-hmm.
We only really grill like once or twice a year.
Yeah.
To help the earth.
Anything else you want to tell me about why you're here?
how you feel about the environment?
I hope some other people can help too. Yeah. Not just us here.
Like who? Who do you think should help?
Well, everyone if they can.
Yeah.
Well, probably everyone's not everyone's going to, but I hope some people do.
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lens. I'm your host, Jessica Rosegard. We'll be back next Friday. And please consider supporting nonprofit journalism in New Orleans. Go to support.thelensnola.org to make a donation today.